I am not a fan of the hard sell. You know what I mean, right? It happens when you walk into a showroom or a store and you're a mess. You are met with high pressure, aggressive salesmanship. That is actually the dictionary definition of a hard sell. You're coerced to buy something without really thinking it through. You got to do it right then. Don't compare it to something else. Some salesmen are not satisfied to let you leave until you've signed on the dotted line to make a decision. And you know, some Christians, some preachers are that way when it comes to evangelism. They can be rather pushy. Now, their heart's in the right place. They really want to see people come to Christ. But when we get pushy, we tend to push people away rather than toward the Savior. Well, I'm glad to announce this morning that Jesus was not that way. If anything, he was sometimes the exact opposite of the hard sell. And we're going to see one such incident this morning. To be sure, he did invite people of his day, as well as us in our own day, to come and follow him. But he was not one for hasty emotional decisions. If anything, Jesus said, come, but think about it first. Luke 14 records a time when Jesus had been the guest of a prominent Pharisee. And on leaving his house and moving out, we're told that large crowds were traveling with Jesus. In verse 25. And Jesus turned to them and said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Jesus had large crowds following him. Most of us would say, way to go, Jesus. You're successful. That's what it's all about. Jesus wasn't so impressed. He knew that many of them were not in the least bit interested in spiritual things. They wanted to be entertained. You know, it's like the little child where, you know, mom or dad or uncle or grandpa, you know, they'll do something, they'll say, hey, do it again, right? That was their attitude with Jesus. Wow, cool miracle, do it again. I imagine some of them were thinking, you know, there's 5,000 on the hillside got a free lunch. Maybe that idea there's no such thing as a free lunch is, you know, maybe there's an exception here. We get something to eat. And I'm sure that some of them were thinking, hey, this is the guy that's going to kick out the Romans and establish Israel again. He's our guy. And Jesus wasn't about any of that stuff. He wanted his followers to know what they were in for. And so he makes this uncompromising demand. See, when it comes to personal discipleship, Jesus is much more interested in quality than he is quantity, which, quite honestly, is something a lot of our churches and ministries need to understand today. It's not all about numbers. When we talk about church growth, growing deep is much more important than growing out. Now, once you grow deep, you can grow out, but you don't want to be a mile wide and an inch deep. And Jesus didn't want that either. And so this is one of several occasions throughout his ministry where he would say something to intentionally thin out the crowds. Now this is clearly an invitation. Jesus uses the magic word, if anyone comes after me. Now that's been our key word throughout this whole series. Come. Jesus says come. Come follow me. But to what are folks invited? Jesus, very clearly here, is inviting them and us to be his disciple. Now, what's a disciple? We tend to relegate disciple to the 12 guys that followed Jesus during his earthly ministry. Maybe that little bigger crowd of 70 that he sometimes dealt with. Now, a disciple is simply a learner. We're going back to school soon. It's a pupil, a student. Honestly, the best synonym I can come up with for disciple back then in our culture today is an apprentice. Think about an apprentice, right? They learn from a master. First, they watch. They just observe what he's doing. Then, little by little, the master will have them try some of the skills necessary. He's right there to, you know, save him from harming himself. But eventually, he'll become proficient enough where he can work on his own. That's what a disciple is. It's an apprentice of Jesus. It's someone who watches, who listens, who learns, and ultimately is able to function. That's what Jesus wants. And that term disciple is the most often used description of Jesus' followers. In the Gospels and in the book of Acts, it's used 264 times. Now, there are some who say there's a difference between being a Christian and being a disciple. You know, Christians are those who are saved, and disciples are those who are, you know, really serious about it. I don't see that distinction in the Bible. In fact, Jesus never anywhere in the gospel says, if anyone wants to be a Christian, he always says, if you want to be my disciple. Think about the Great Commission, Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Go and make what? Disciples of all nations. Not converts, not Christians. That word hadn't even been invented yet. Disciples of all nations. And what were those disciples to be taught? To obey everything I've commanded you. That's what an apprentice does. That's what a disciple is. So this distinction between Christians and disciples, I think, is a false one. If you're following Jesus, you're a disciple. If you're not a disciple, you're not following Jesus. You're not saved. Now, don't get me wrong. The conditions that Jesus lays down here should not be understood as works necessary for salvation. This is more of an evidence that salvation has happened. This is a litmus test for discipleship. It's not how you become a disciple. It's proof that you are one. We are saved by grace through faith and in no other way. It is only the grace of God by which we are saved. But we are saved in order to follow Jesus, not just go along for the ride because I've got my get out of hell free card. Jesus calls us to follow him. Now, the first part of Jesus' uncompromising demand seems very severe. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, cannot be my disciple. And I'm sure some of you are thinking, no, wait a minute, Jesus. Are you serious? We're supposed to hate? Well, obviously not. I mean, elsewhere Jesus said you're supposed to love your enemies. So you love your enemies and hate your family? Is that what he's saying? No. He is not saying that. What he is saying is that nothing less than wholehearted commitment is acceptable for a disciple of Jesus. It means giving our first loyalty to him. Now, I think it'll help to understand how the word hate was understood in the first century. In our terminology, hate is an intense hostility, an aversion usually driven by anger or fear, some sense of injury. It's an extreme dislike. It's an antipathy towards someone or something. But in the ancient world, hate was more of a matter of priorities. How important is something to you? For example, back in Genesis 25, remember the story of Jacob and Esau? Esau had been out hunting, hadn't got a thing, comes back, tired, hungry, and there's Jacob over a pot of stew. And Esau says, "Oh man, I am so hungry, I could die. Give me a bowl of that stew." And Jacob says, "Give me your birthright first." And Esau says, "What good's a birthright if I starve to death?" "Fine." And the Bible says that Esau despised his birthright. Now, I don't think he had any negative feelings toward his birthright. In fact, later on, he wanted it back. But in that moment, where he had to make a choice between my birthright and a bowl of stew, he made a choice that, by comparison, made it look like he hated his birthright. It's a comparative idea. And that's how Jesus uses it here. Jesus isn't saying that we should actively hate others. He's saying that, by comparison, to your love for me, it should seem like you hate everybody else. I should come so far high in your list of priorities that everybody else starts at about number 20. That's what he is saying here. Our love for Christ must be so strong that our love for others would be like hate in comparison. There's a parallel passage in Matthew that I think helps. It's Matthew chapter 10 and verses 37 and 38. Jesus says, "Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me." That's the idea. Nothing can come before our loyalty to Jesus. And that means mother and father. That means husband or wife. That means son or daughter. That means grandkids. So now you're meddling, right? You get to grandkids. Nothing comes before Jesus. That is his demand. And that is the cost of being a disciple. In a practical sense, it means placing all of our goals, our objectives, our plans, our personal desires under that of the Father. The truly committed follower of Jesus releases their own will while embracing the Father's will. And that's nothing less than Jesus did himself. Remember the Garden of Gethsemane? Remember when he prayed, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me, yet not my will but yours be done." I know we end every worship service with the Lord's Prayer. That's really the Lord's Prayer right there. "Not my will but yours be done." And that should be a part of every prayer we ever pray, that his will be done. Now there's another aspect to this demand of Jesus, and that is that his disciples carry the cross. What does that mean? I know some people think of their cross as, you know, their job, right? Or maybe it's a physical condition that they deal with, or maybe it's their mother-in-law, or who knows. That's the cross I must bear, right? That is not at all what Jesus is talking about here. Again, understand what the cross meant when he spoke these words. For a disciple to carry his cross means that every day we identify with his shame, his suffering, and his surrender. We watch movies like The Passion of the Christ, and we get just a glimpse of the suffering of crucifixion. But there was more to it than the suffering. There was also the shame. Not only was crucifixion the most agonizing way to die, it was also the most humiliating. And you completely surrendered yourself to be nailed to a cross. That is what Jesus endured. And he did it not for himself, he did it for us. But he calls for his disciples to carry their cross. It won't be the same cross. In fact, for us, it would be very unlikely that it would even be a literal cross. And it's not always going to be the same. Our experiences are not the same. Some will be called upon to suffer more. Some will be called upon to surrender more. But the idea is we are willing to surrender it all. We are willing, whatever the cost, as we sang earlier. That's what it means. To call our noisy neighbors a cross we must bear shows that we don't have the slightest idea what a cross is all about. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a man who did know. He was a German theologian back in World War II. He was eventually executed days before the end of the war because of his stand for Jesus. He wrote probably his most famous book, The Cost of Discipleship. When Christ calls a man, he calls him to come and die. Pretty much what Jesus is saying right here. He went on to write in that book, if our Christianity has ceased to be serious about discipleship, if we have watered down the gospel into emotional uplift that makes no costly demands and which fails to distinguish between the natural and the Christian experience, then we cannot help but regard the cross as ordinary everyday calamity, as one of the trials and tribulations of life. When we think that the little petty things that bother us is our cross, we just prove we don't know what a cross is. And that's not what Jesus meant. What he meant was that if you're going to follow me, it's going to cost you something. That something is not always identical, but it's always something. Jesus said in John 15:20, if they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. For some, that might mean physical beating. Some, that might mean emotional rejection. Some, that might mean loss of property, loss of a job, being passed over for a promotion. For some, it may be laying down your life. Are we willing to pay that price? Because we all will suffer in one way or another for being a Christian. Now, this whole bit about, you know, hating father and mother and, you know, husband and wife and children and brother and sister, seems a bit severe. Where did Jesus come off with such extreme ideas? Well, they weren't his initially. He actually got them from a very familiar place. One I'm sure you've all heard of. It's called the Ten Commandments. What is commandment one? As recorded in Exodus 20, verse 3, you will have no other gods before me. God forbids idolatry. He is the only God. We can only worship him. From the very beginning, God demanded first place in the lives of his people. And some of us are thinking, well, I don't have to worry about that one. Don't have any idols in my house. I'm not worshiping some statue or some rock or some tree. Got that one covered. We read verses like 1 John 5:21 that says, "Dear children, keep yourself from idols." And that doesn't apply to me. Don't have any idols. But then you read that same verse in the New Living Translation, and it says, "Dear children, keep away from anything that might take God's place in your heart." Uh-oh. Now that means something different. Because that can be anyone, it can be anything. It can be a dream, it can be a career, it can be a hobby. Anything that comes before Christ is an idol. And he will not permit those who claim to follow him to have any allegiance higher than him. And this brings us to the ultimate decision. Now again, Jesus is not using hard sell tactics here. He doesn't want disciples who didn't realize what they got themselves into. Counting the cost is very important. So in verses 28 to 33, back in Luke 14, Jesus offered two analogies to illustrate conscious, eyes wide open commitment. Both depict people making all or nothing decisions before proceeding. Jesus did not want foolhardy promises. He did not want fickle disciples who do more harm than good to the cause. No, he only wants those who take on the hardships with a reasonable understanding of the cost. Notice what he says. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, "This fellow began to build and was not able to finish." Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000 men? I'm not a math major, but I think I know those odds. If he is not able, he'll send a delegation while the other is a long way off and ask for terms of peace. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. That is the ultimate decision. And these are clear warnings from Jesus. Before you make that choice, you better count the cost. Understand what it requires. He's only willing to have those who are all in to be his disciple. Now, I'm not saying we all have to take vows of poverty, sell everything we own. What he's talking about here are more the emotional attachments to the things we have. When we love them more than we love him. A characteristic of a materialistic society is when people love things and use people. Well, if we love things and try to use God, God says, nothing doing. If we think we can love anything more than Jesus, he says, I don't want you. I don't want the numbers. Like the rich young ruler. Oh, yeah, go sell all that you have and then come follow me. He didn't say that to everybody, but he said it to him. Why? Because he knew that that man had a greater attachment to his wealth than he did following Jesus. And he will not allow that. He demands first place. So when it comes to our possessions, we're allowed to enjoy them. We ought to use them to bless others, but hold them very loosely. It means recognizing that we are a steward of all that we have, not the owner. If you really think about it, God owns everything, right? He allows us to enjoy what we have for a time because we're not going to take it with us. And when our life comes to an end, somebody else is going to get it, or more likely, they're just going to throw it in the dumpster. Let's be real. But it's still God's. He is the owner. So we should thank Him for the use of them. We should use them for His glory. We should bless others with them. But we must not claim ownership over them. That's what it means to surrender all that we have to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. It means, Lord, whatever I have, You can take. And that might be my house, that might be my car, that might be my job, it might be my reputation, it might be my husband or wife, it might be my child. You say, God wouldn't do that. Oh, He already has. Read the story about Abraham when he was told to go sacrifice his son, his only son. Abraham was willing to do it. Now, he didn't have to go through it, but he was willing. That's what Jesus is looking for. That kind of devotion, that kind of dedication. Unconditional surrender to His Lordship. It's the only response that will open the gates of the kingdom. Now, the world sees that as high a cost as you can pay. But from a kingdom perspective, it's really no sacrifice at all. As Jim Elliot, the missionary martyr, said many years ago, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. That's discipleship. I give him everything that I can't keep anyway, in order to gain something that no one can take from me. That's wise. That's a good investment. Because in the end, you lose nothing. Nothing that really matters. So these words condemn all half-heartedness. Jesus isn't discouraging discipleship. He's warning against an ill-considered, faint-hearted attachment to those who claim to follow Him, so that they might know what the real thing is. He wants them to count the cost and to count all as lost for the sake of following Him, because that's how you know what full-blooded discipleship is all about. Now, you're not going to hear this message preached very much today. As John Stott put it, the Christian landscape is strewn with the wreckage of derelict, half-built towers, the ruins of those who began to build and were unable to finish. For thousands of people still ignore Christ's warning and undertake to follow Him without first pausing to reflect on the cause to do so. The result is the great scandal of Christianity, so-called nominal Christians. In countries to which Christian civilization has spread, large number of people have covered themselves with a thin, respectable veneer of Christianity. They have allowed themselves to be somewhat involved, enough to be respectable, but not enough to be uncomfortable. Their religion is a great soft cushion. It protects them from the hard unpleasantness of life while changing its place and its shape to suit their convenience. No wonder cynics speak of hypocrites in the church and dismiss religion as escapism. What is the number one reason why people don't want to go to church or come to Christ?
Hypocrites.
Okay. They got a point. Because there's an awful lot of people, especially in our country, where the cost is minimal, in the obvious sense, who say they follow Jesus, but they're really not. They come and they sing the hymns and they pray the prayers and they read the scriptures and they say, you know, all the right things. But it's not real. And when push comes to shove, their true colors show, and the world looks and says, that's a phony. Jesus wanted to stop all that before it ever started. If you're not willing to give it all, don't start. Jesus Christ demands total allegiance. So if you're determined to live a life of easygoing self-indulgence, take my advice and stay away from Christianity. Jesus Christ is not for you. See, Jesus says, come, but think it over first. He doesn't want half-hearted followers whose commitment sways with every emotional wind. You're either a loyal disciple of Christ or you're a lost sinner. There is no in between. So I challenge you this morning, are you really following Jesus? Is there anything in your life that comes before him? If push comes to shove and it's either this or Jesus, if there's anything that comes before Jesus, we got a problem. That needs to be surrendered to him. And it might be the dearest thing to you. It might be a member of your family. And it's not that God is cruel and he's going to say, I'm going to take him from you. But God has a plan that's so far beyond our comprehension. We don't know. I know back in 1957, when those five missionaries were killed in Ecuador, people were like, what is God doing? These guys are in their 20s. They're at the very beginning of their life. Think of all that Jim Elliot might have done if he had lived a long life. God said, I got a different plan. And it was through their sacrifice that a whole tribe of people came to know Jesus. Was that worth the cost? God would say yes. And I do believe that to a man, every one of those five would have also agreed. Their families might have had a different idea. And that might be the cost. It might not be us. It might be someone we love. Are we willing to let go? Are we willing to say, whatever it takes, I'm willing to lay it at the cross? Because Jesus will take nothing less.